Welcome to Geek Orthodox. I'm Father Justin, geeked from my youth. And in this first real episode of the podcast, I want to start what I hope will be a series of episodes derived from my talk at DoxCon Seattle on the deaths of Arthur. In this first episode, I want to talk about the historical context and sources for Arthur. Whether or not Arthur was a real person, whether he was a king, or simply a war leader, as Nennius has him, Dux Ballorum, Arthur becomes a hugely important figure. Why? To me, that's the key question, and one of the reasons why I wanted to focus on the deaths of Arthur. Why is the death of this one man so important? Why does it resonate so deeply with the British people? And in order to understand this, I think we need to kind of set the scene a little bit. When we think about the time period in which Arthur would have lived, we don't necessarily have the full context for it. In order to get that, we need to think about Britain as it was at that period of time, around about the year 500 or so. But in order to understand that, we need to go back further in history, because Britain at this time was basically falling apart. Falling apart in the sense that for a good 350 years, Britain had been a part of the Roman Empire. The Roman conquest of Britain begins in around AD 43. Julius Caesar did make an expedition to Britain earlier on, but really it doesn't get started till Claudius sends four legions to Britain in AD 43. And those four legions spend the next 4 years or so conquering the southeast of Britain. Southeast is what's called Fosse Way, which is probably some sort of defensive dike that the Romans built that later was turned into a road that kind of cuts right across the diagonally across Britain and contains the regions of London, of Devonshire, and of East Anglia. That kind of southeastern part of Britain was what was first conquered by the Romans. This conquest then was then expanded in the years 77 to 84, in which the Romans conquered most of the island of Britain, as far north as Caledonia, to be northern Scotland, up until what was the Antonine Wall, a wall that was actually north of Hadrian's Wall, briefly built by the Romans and abandoned, maybe 20 years later. But when we think about Romanized Britain, it really gets started, I guess, with that conquest and then the establishment of that conquest. So around about AD 150, by about AD 150, you had what is the current network of Roman roads that span most of modern day England completed. And then from that period, the British understood themselves as a part of the Roman Empire until things start to fall apart. And while I won't go into a whole lot of detail, it's worth noting that there were a number of different emperors or would-be emperors who actually originated in Britain and even took troops from Britain down south, took troops most significantly out of Britain, leaving Britain more or less defenseless. So that by the time we get to about AD 410, Britain is in really dire straits. The Scots and the Picts are coming down from the north. They're raiding indiscriminately. There's no troops left to defend Roman Britain from these depredations of the northern invaders. And they actually send a letter to Emperor Honorius, who was himself under siege at Ravenna at the time. So really bad timing. In 410, they send this letter down to Emperor Honorius, and Emperor Honorius responds by saying, "Sorry, guys, you're on your own." So this rescript of Honorius kind of is the end date, so to speak, or kind of is often understood as the formal end date of the Roman occupation of Britain. From this point on, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles actually say from 409 on, Britain was no longer a part of the Roman Empire. They were literally on their own. And perhaps predictably, things fell apart. But in order to understand the kind of the magnitude of that, I think it's helpful for us to think about it in terms that we might know. So I'm Canadian, here in Canada. Canada is understood to have been founded in 1867, although of course its history goes further back than that, to about, the 1600s. And so Canada as a nation has existed for what? This is 2024, so I'm really bad at math. It's about maybe 150 years. Roman Britain existed from AD 43 to AD 410. So that's more like, again, I'm really bad at math, but it's more like 350 years. When we think about all this as well in terms of our just own personal histories, like I kind of have some sort of first-hand knowledge of, or first or second-hand knowledge, if you will, of history going back to about, say, my grandfather's day. I knew my grandfather. He died when I was 10. He came over to Canada in 1908. So my own kind of personal first-hand history, if you will, of Canada, my country, goes back to, let's say, 1908, when my grandfather came across. That's what, again, maybe 125 years. And Arthur, let's say he's around 490 to 500 and something. This is, within the memory, if you will, the sort of generational memory of the people that Arthur would have lived with, you had a memory of a civilization that had brought roads, had brought cities, had brought baths, had brought all sorts of knowledge and governance and safety to the British island, to the island of England, for 350 years. But this was now no longer the case by the time of Arthur, and hadn't been within this kind of generational memory. But it was not completely gone. There was still an attempt at this point, as we'll see, to kind of keep the regions, the cities, the nations, because at this point it was kind of fragmented, that were there and were still Romanized Britons, safe from the incursions of the Northerners. So, okay, hopefully that sets the stage, that gives us maybe a sense, I hope, of, or will help to give us a sense of why the death of Arthur is so significant, particularly when we start to look at the historical sources, the texts that we have. So, what do we have in terms of text and history from this period? Well, obviously, we have the Ecclesiastical History of the English People by the Venerable Bede, who famously does not mention Arthur at all. But I mention that because he doesn't mention Arthur. That I think is potentially significant, something at least we have to consider. But we do have some historical sources that do mention Arthur. Most notably, and probably a good starting point, are the Annals of Wales. The British people, the Romanized Britons, who were displaced by the invaders, most notably the Anglo-Saxon invaders, retreated to areas like Wales and Cornwall, and continued to exist as a people. And they kept records, most notably these annals. Annals, of course, being a year by year. This is what happened in this year. This is what happened in this year. And so in the Annals of Wales, we have this entry for the year 72. I'm actually not sure offhand what 72 is dated from, which says, "The Battle of Badon, in which Arthur carried the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ on his shoulders for 3 days and 3 nights, and the Britons were victors. We'll come back to the Battle of Badon in a minute, the dating of which is, it was a hugely significant event, the dating of which is difficult. It's often dated AD 516, but I've heard it dated much earlier, possibly as early as 490. The dating system at that time was not super well established. Things could be dated from the passion of our Lord, his death, or they could be dated from his birth. It wasn't firmly established, and that made for some potential for error. So it's quite possible that the scribe dating it in this particular year from thinking that it was from the passion of Christ might have been from the birth of Christ, which would give a fairly significantly earlier date, like 590. We don't know for certain. We'll get to more of the Battle of Badon in a minute. The second entry in which Arthur is mentioned is the year 93, where it says, "The strife of Camlann, in which Arthur and Medrot, Mordred, fell, and there was death in Britain and in Ireland." This is the very first mention that we have in the historical record of the death of Arthur. The Annals of Wales was, like most annals, a compilation of sources. It was derived from a variety of different sources. Like if you look at, say, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, they go back to the year, well, basically the year one, and there's all sorts of interesting bits in it where it talks about the passing of Pope Clement in 101, in the year 38, Pilate killed himself with his own hand, and so on. So you've got most of these annals are compilations of earlier sources. Which, in the eyes of modern scholars, makes some of their dating a little questionable, because we tend to prefer first-hand accounts. That being said, when history is made up of all sorts of documents that are lost, and we have attestations to some of those documents that are lost, I don't think we should necessarily dismiss them out of hand. So these are two really important early references to Arthur. But of course, it's not that simple. It never is with history. One of the reasons that it's not simple is that, of course, we don't have copies of the Annals of Wales that go back this far. The earliest actually extant manuscript that we have is a 12th century copy of a 10th century original. So, and by the 10th century, you were already getting all sorts of other references to Arthur in the historical record. If these are compilations, it's quite possible that they're compilations from earlier sources, but it is also possible that they are compilations that include data from later sources. So while these are important attestations to the historical Arthur, they're not necessarily definitive. Why not? Well, one of the reasons for this complication is one of the earliest extant writings that we have about this time period was Gildas's On the Ruin and Conquest of Britain. Gildas was actually a contemporary, or would have been a contemporary, of Arthur. He actually says that his birthday was the date of the Battle of Badon. So he would have grown up in the time of Arthur. And in this extended written homily on the ruin of Britain, he doesn't mention Arthur at all. Why not? It's a really key question. Because you would expect, if Arthur existed and if he was such an important figure, then of course somebody like who was a contemporary of his, Gildas, would of course mention him. And in fact, this did not go unnoticed. Gildas's 12th century hagiographer is troubled enough by this, because by the 12th century, Arthur, whether or not he actually existed, is definitively considered to exist. He comes up with an explanation to say that that Arthur had gone unmentioned by Gildas after Arthur killed the saint's brother, Huil Mab Ca. Sorry, I'm probably mangling the Celtic here. But so in the 12th century, we have somebody writing about Gildas who's concerned, wait a second, why is this contemporary of Arthur not mentioning Arthur? It must be because he was mad because Arthur killed Gildas's brother. It's a possible explanation, definitely one added after the fact, and it's attempting to address this very key question. This contemporary of Arthur doesn't mention him at all. We'll get back to this, but I think it's also fascinating here again to kind of flesh out the historical context in which Arthur lived, to read a little bit of Gildas's description of the ruin and conquest of Britain. So, quoting now from this homily, Gildas says, "A council is held." And he's talking about a council held to deliberate, as he says, what means ought to be determined upon as the best and safest to repel such fatal and frequent eruptions and plunderings by the Scots and the Picts. So the Scots and the Picts were coming down, and they needed to hold this council to figure out, well, what do we do? How do we defend ourselves? Continuing with Gildas. "At that time, all members of the assembly, along with this proud tyrant, are blinded. Such is the protection they find for their country. It was, in fact, its destruction that those wild Saxons of accursed name, hated by God and men, should be admitted into the island like wolves into folds in order to repel the northern nation." So like many of their contemporaries in the Roman Empire, as they're trying to figure out how do we defend ourselves, Rome is falling apart. They often turned to barbarians, good barbarian warriors, to come in and help them fight off other barbarians. This could have, very, very, very beneficial effects. That's kind of how what happened in Gaul with the barbarians there. They became landed. They became a part of the culture. They helped to drive away the barbarians. Eventually, though, a lot of these arrangements backfired because these semi-Romanized barbarians, or sometimes not even Romanized at all, barbarians who are being hired to drive away the other barbarians, decide, hey, wait a second, maybe we can take advantage of this. And this is exactly what Gildas goes on to document. Continuing on with Gildas. "They sailed out, and at the directions of the unlucky tyrant, first fixed their dreadful talons on the eastern part of the island, as men intending to fight for the country, but more truly to assail it. To these, the mother of the brood, finding that success had attended the first contingent, sends out also a larger raft full of accomplices and curs, which sails over and joins itself to their bastard comrades. From that source, the seed of iniquity, the root of bitterness, grows as a poisonous plant, worthy of our deserts, in our own soil, furnished with rugged branches and leaves." Jump in for a moment here. This is definitely a homily. Gildas has all sorts of scriptural quotes and metaphors that are very similar to scripture. So he's saying basically they invited them over, said, "Please help defend us." This gives them a chance to take root like a plant, a poisonous plant. I said worthy of our deserts. I should have been, sorry, worthy of our desserts. And he's condemning the British people for being unfaithful to God and saying that the ruin of Britain that they are experiencing is the consequence of their unfaithfulness to God, in beautiful rhetorical terms. Continuing on, "Thus the barbarians admitted into the island succeed in having provisions supplied them, as if they were soldiers and about to encounter, as they falsely averred, great hardships for their kind hosts. These provisions, acquired for a length of time, closed, as the saying is, the dog's maw. They complain again that their monthly supplies were not copiously contributed to them, intentionally coloring their opportunities, and declare that if larger munificence were not piled upon them, they would break the treaty and lay waste the whole of the island. They made no delay to follow up their threats with deeds." So, in other words, the barbarians are coming in, The Anglo-Saxons, that is, are coming in. They bring more in, saying, "Hey, we'll help you. Just give us some provisions, and we'll engage in the hardship of countering your enemies, these terrible Scots and Picts." And then, after this happens for a while, they get used to, once you kind of establish something and you get used to it, it becomes this, well, this is the pattern. This is what happens. So they then say, "Hey, wait a second. We're not getting as much as we should. You've always given us this food, and now we're not getting enough supplies from you. And so we're going to lay waste your realm." How exactly this worked in terms of history, who knows? I mean, maybe they really did want to come over and help, and maybe they really were not well supplied by the inhabitants of the island, and then got mad. Certainly, from the perspective of the Britons, the Romanized Britons, this was a betrayal. And now we have a vivid description of exactly how this betrayal played out. "In this way," Gildas says, "all the settlements were brought low with the frequent shocks of the battering rams. The inhabitants, along with the bishops of the church, both priests and people, while swords gleamed on every side and flames crackled, were together mown down to the ground, and sad sight, they were seen in the midst of streets, the bottom stones of towers with tall beams cast down, and of high walls, sacred altars, fragments of bodies covered with clots as if coagulated of red blood, in confusion as in a kind of horrible wine press. There was no sepulchre of any kind save the ruins of houses or the entrails of wild beasts and birds in the open. I say it with reverence to their holy souls, if in fact there were many to be found holy, that would be carried by holy angels to the heights of heaven. For the vineyard, at one time good, had then so far degenerated to bitter fruit that rarely could be seen, according to the prophet, any cluster of grapes or ear of corn, as it were, behind the back of the vintagers or reapers. Some of the wretched remnant were consequently captured on the mountains and killed in heaps. Others, overcome by hunger, came and yielded themselves to their enemies to be their slaves forever, if they were not instantly slain, which was the equivalent to the highest service. Others repaired to parts beyond the sea with strong lamentation. Others, trusting their lives always with apprehension of mind to high hills overhanging, precipitous and fortified, and to dense forests and rocks of the sea, remained in their native land, though with fear. After a certain length of time, the cruel robbers returned to their home. A remnant, to whom wretched citizens flocked from different places on every side, as eagerly as a hive of bees when a storm is threatening, praying at the same time unto him, capital H him, God, with their whole heart, and, as is said, burdening the air with unnumbered prayers that they should not be utterly destroyed, take up arms and challenge their victors to battle under Ambrosius Aurelianus. He was a man of unassuming character who alone of the Roman race chanced to survive in the shock of such a storm, as his parents, people undoubtedly clad in the purple, had been killed in it, whose offspring in our days have greatly degenerated from their ancestral nobleness. To these men, by the Lord's favor, there came victory." Okay, and we'll get to the Battle of Badon in just a minute. That's the next part of Gildas's homily. But here we have this vivid description of the experience, perhaps not of Gildas himself, because that's not the situation, as we'll see in a moment, in Gildas's own day, but certainly within the living memory of Gildas and his the people that he would have had contact with. This is a description from what they remember of the destruction of the cities, the corpses lying out in the open, the flight to the hills and the fortresses, across the sea. And then in the midst of this chaos, one man becomes a focal point, who helps them to take up arms, and his name is recorded right here, Ambrosius Aurelianus. Gildas says or assumes that his parents were noble on some level, but had died in the troubles. Gildas also is aware of descendants of Ambrosius Aurelianus. What is key for Gildas is that it's under Ambrosius Aurelianus that the Britons finally gather together and take up arms themselves to resist the Anglo-Saxon invaders. It goes on then, from that time, the citizens were sometimes victorious, sometimes the enemy, in order that the Lord, according to his wont, might try this nation, the Israel of today, whether it loves him or not. This continued up to the year of the siege of Badon Hill, and of almost the last great slaughter inflicted upon the rascally crew. And this commences, a fact I know, as the 44th year, with 1 month now elapsed. It is also the year of my birth. So, here we finally get to the Battle of Badon Hill, or as Gildas calls it, the Siege of Badon Hill, in which a great slaughter is inflicted upon the Anglo-Saxons. And this slaughter, as Gildas goes on to say, buys the Britons some peace for a time. And so this is the time in which Gildas himself was growing up. As he says, the Battle of Badon Hill was at took place in the year of his birth. And so Gildas himself has experienced a time of relative peace, but that's kind of coming to an end, and he's now reflecting from a theological perspective on what this means for the people of Britain. Why would God allow this? He allows this to test them. He sees his people as kind of as Christians, as opposed to the pagan Anglo-Saxons, as a continuation of the nation of Israel, kind of traditional understanding of the church. But of course, he, in this mention of the Battle of Badon Hill, having just mentioned Ambrosius Aurelianus, he doesn't mention Arthur, which is kind of significant, given that, you know, what did we see? The first recorded instance of Arthur, the recorded mention of Arthur, at least from the perspective of the Annals of Wales, is the Battle of Badon. Why no mention of Arthur? If Ambrosius Aurelianus is a historical figure, which he certainly seems to be, given his frequent mention in not only Gildas but other sources, why no mention of Arthur? Could it be that Arthur didn't exist? He's ahistorical. Possibly. Could also be that he was just so well known that he didn't need to mention him. Just so well known that it was just assumed. Could it be that he was not relevant to Gildas's homiletical purposes? But if that's the case, then why mention Ambrosius Aurelianus and not Arthur? So we've had this explanation that is offered by Gildas's 12th century hagiographer. It's quite possible he didn't like Arthur because he killed his brother. But you know, we can't actually resolve this. All we know is that here we have a historical source which is talking about, you know, the very content that is the stuff of the Arthurian legend, and there's no mention of Arthur, but there is mention of Ambrosius Aurelianus. So this doesn't bode well for the historicity of Arthur, particularly if you're inclined to say, well, you know, these, yeah, he's mentioned in the Annals of Wales, but he's not, but he's not mentioned in this contemporary source. So why do we think that Arthur is historical? Well, he does appear in songs, in stories, and in the historical record. So, like aside from the Annals of Wales, we do also have reference to Arthur in another really important early source, the History of the Britons. The History of the Britons is historically attributed to Nennius. It's written about AD 828, although the preface that Nennius gives dates itself as AD 558. Nennius says in his preface that his motive is to preserve in Latin the history of his own people. This is important because Latin is, of course, the language of the church, the language of scholarship, the language which is it's an international language now, with the re-Christianization of the West, and so writing in Latin is an important way to preserve history. And Nennius says in his preface that it's compiled partly from writings and monuments of the ancient inhabitants of Britain, partly from the annals of the Romans, and the chronicles of the sacred fathers, Isidore, Hieronymus, Prosper, Eusebius, and from the history of the Scots and Saxons, although our enemies, not following my own inclinations, but to the best of my ability, obeying the commands of my seniors, because, and Nennius says this is because he was indignant that the name of his own people, formerly famous and distinguished, should sink into oblivion. And he says he would rather be the historian of the Britons than nobody. So this is the preface, as I say, that's attributed to Nennius. Whether or not Nennius wrote it is a matter of some controversy. Odds are it's a compilation, and maybe Nennius is affixing his name to the compilation after the fact. Maybe he took a previous compilation and himself added to it. We don't know, but it's a fairly early history of the Britons, written in Latin. And it references Arthur. And it also is worth noting that Nennius is using sources, ancient sources, by his own attestation, that aren't available to us, that we don't have. And so it's an important historical witness that references sources that have disappeared from the historical record. He also notes that after the de death of Saint Germanus, the Saxons increased greatly in Britain, both in strength and number. And then he gets into the main quote about Arthur, which I won't go into all the detail because he lists 12 different battles that Arthur fights in. But he says, "Then it was that the magnanimous Arthur, with all the kings and military force of Britain, fought against the Saxons. And though there were many more noble than himself, yet he was 12 times chosen their commander and was as often conqueror." And then he goes into his list of battles, first, second, third, and so on. The eighth, he says, was near Gurion Castle, where Arthur bore the image of the Holy Virgin, Mother of God, upon his shoulders, and through the power of our Lord Jesus Christ and the Holy Mary, put the Saxons to flight and pursued them the whole day with great slaughter. The 12th, he says, was a most severe contest when Arthur penetrated to the hill of Badon. In this engagement, 940 fell by his hand alone, no one but the Lord offering him assistance. In all these engagements, the Britons were successful, for no strength can avail against the will of Almighty. So these are the two main references that we can reconcile or that track with the annals of Wales. Talks about Arthur again. It's again talks about Arthur bearing the image of the Holy Virgin, the Mother of God, upon his shoulders. Note here that the words for shoulder and shield are apparently easily confused in Old Welsh. I don't speak Old Welsh. Apparently, shield is, I'll probably mangle the pronunciation, skuit versus shoulder, which is skuid. So it's quite possible here that these multiple references to Arthur wearing the image of the Virgin on his shield or the cross of our Lord on his shoulders could well be that these were on his shield. And of course, we now have here in Nennius's historical record the 12th and most important battle that Arthur was involved in. At being the siege of Badon, the Battle of Badon, talks about him penetrating to the hill of Badon. So it does sound like there's Badon is perhaps something at some sort of fortification at any rate that would be besieged, and then was penetrated, and Arthur seems to have been quite the warrior. 940 fell by his hand alone, so he was instrumental in vanquishing the Saxons to such a degree that they no longer troubled the land, as Gildas himself attests to. So it's a very key engagement, and Arthur, according to Nennius, was involved in it. Also, really interesting here is that Nennius refers to Arthur as a war leader, Dux Ballorum in Latin. He's chosen, and he says specifically, then it was that the magnanimous Arthur, with all the kings and military force of Britain, fought against the Saxons. And although there were many more noble than himself, yet he was 12 times chosen their commander and was often conqueror. So the historical witness that we have in Nennius, who is, as I say, is referencing other historical sources that are no longer extant, seems to indicate that Arthur is not necessarily a king, but rather a war leader who is under a king. And very interestingly, jumping ahead quite a bit in the historical record, we have also William of Malmesbury, one of the preeminent historians of his own day, also a librarian, somebody. He writes The History of the Kings of England in AD 1125, so a bit after the Norman conquest, second edition in 1127. He has one reference to Arthur, which is fascinating here. He says, when Vortimer died, Vortimer having been somebody who defended the British and governed the kingdom, the British strength decayed and all hope fled from them, and they would soon have perished altogether had not Ambrosius, the sole survivor of the Romans, who became monarch after Vortigern, quelled the presumptuous barbarians by the powerful aid of warlike Arthur. It is of this Arthur that the Britons fondly tell so many fables, even to the present day, a man worthy to be celebrated not by idle fictions, but by authentic history. He long upheld the sinking state and roused the broken spirit of his countrymen to war. Finally, at the siege of Mount Badon, relying on an image of the Virgin which he had affixed to his armor, he engaged 900 of the enemy single-handed and dispersed them with incredible slaughter. So, William of Malmesbury has a really interesting take on this. Essentially, what he's saying is that Arthur wasn't king, he was a warlord. The king was Ambrosius. And Ambrosius Aurelianus, the sole survivor of the Romans, who became monarch after Vortigern, quelled the presumptuous barbarians by the powerful aid of warlike Arthur. Arthur then is a warrior. He is a war leader. He is a very powerful warrior in that he somehow manages to kill 900 of the enemy single-handedly in as he's breaking, presumably, or triumphing at the siege of Badon Hill, the Battle of Badon. And so it's quite possible here that Arthur did exist, but that he wasn't actually king. And it is certain that what we have here is the resistance of the British people to the Anglo-Saxons, whom they themselves had invited in to defend them against the Scots and the Picts. To defend Romanized Britain, the last remnants of Romanized Britain against these barbarian invaders, and now having to defend themselves against the barbarians that they had invited in, this coalesces around two figures, Ambrosius and his war leader Arthur. And it's only after Arthur's death that things really continue to degenerate and go downhill, and that things completely fall apart. So, whether or not this is the actual historical event, William of Malmesbury says that it's of this Arthur this Arthur, this warlike Arthur, this war leader that the Britons fondly tell so many fables, even to the present day. The Britons, the British people, still remember and revere the figure of Arthur as the last defense against the darkness. And so they celebrate him. So they look to him. So even just like another witness just a few years later say they look to him as someone who may yet come again and deliver them from the hands of their enemies. So he becomes this not only this war leader but this messianic figure. Now, did he exist? We probably can't definitively tell at this point at this late point in history, but he certainly comes to exist in the minds and in the hearts of the British people. And so and his death marks the end of an era, an end when the British people had some semblance of civilization, some semblance of ability to defend themselves against the forces of barbarism and darkness that are descend and chaos that are descending upon their beloved land, their beloved country. So it's this historical kernel that becomes the seed for the literary Arthur that we will be looking at in subsequent episodes, and becomes the seed for a messianic figure, somebody who is, in some respects, a Christ figure to the British people. So, whether or not Arthur actually existed, historically speaking, he becomes such an important figure that I think it's worth looking at not only his death, but also all that he represents to the British people, and by extension to the people of all English-speaking countries, of which I myself am a geeky representative.